My name is Renee Hernandez. I represent the plaintiff, Mark Brandt. As the court is aware, Mr. Brandt has filed a 1983 claim against two individual officers, Fred Katz and Wendell McLean, for their actions on May 8, 1998. Just a quick overview, and that is on May 8th, early evening or late afternoon, Mr. Brandt is heading home from his workplace. He's completely paralyzed from the waist down and has absolutely no use of his legs, paraplegic. He's bound to a wheelchair. He has modified a scooter so that it can obtain or hold his wheelchair, and in the city of Freeport, obviously, there are no sidewalks, so the streets must be traversed for someone with a handicap. So he did so. He's in his scooter, and during the course of his riding home, he stopped by the police officers in question. Mr. Katz then begins a series of investigations to determine whether or not he had a valid license, etc. And we're talking about a traffic offense right here. He stopped in front of civilian witnesses, in which we had several witnesses that testified, and that depositions are part of the record. So those civilian witnesses observed what was going on. In this particular instance, we have this officer approaching him, and then upon receiving information that Mr. Brandt had a revoked license, he proceeded to effectuate an arrest. So it was clear that he was operating under the color of law and that Mr. Brandt was in custody. There was no question about either one of those propositions. The next question comes in the manner in which he's arrested. Now, there's a dispute as to how he was arrested, because Mr. Brandt indicates that there was a gun placed or put in front of his face. The officers dispute that factual dispute. Next component is the way they took him off of the scooter and brought him to the car.
Forgive me for interrupting, but if there's no statute or case law, and I see none in your brief, which speaks to the way in which police officers have to handle disabled individuals in a situation like this one, don't we necessarily have a qualified immunity problem?
I believe that the court can look to Katz and the recent Supreme Court case, and I think it does tell us that an action can be maintained without a prior case on point. And
it's very clear, but what do you think the police should have done here?
Well, the police should have done is to handle this individual who has no apparatus to defend himself or to...
Concretely, what should they have done rather than carrying him to the police car?
Well, certainly they could have carried him in the police car and placed him in that car in a whole different manner.
Well, you say he was corkscrewed. Is there any specific evidence as to what exactly that means?
Corkscrewed, and according to the plaintiff's deposition, is literally that he was twisted and his body was manipulated. And obviously because of he's a very small man, a petite man, with no use of his legs whatsoever. He has his legs that dangle underneath him. All right, and that's how they had him. And by turning the corkscrew, literally, his description is that they're manipulating his body to cause him pain. And then, according to the plaintiff, they bang his back off the steel door well, right, and jamming him in there forcefully. Obviously, in this particular instance, the problem is that no force is necessary. We know from Graham and O'Connor that we look to the minorness of the offense here. It's a traffic offense. The threat that this individual poses to the officers, there was no threat whatsoever. And I think the police officers actually acknowledged that in their own brief and their own words in the summary judgment. And we can look at the defendant's brief on page 25.
But the problem is this. The record doesn't seem to shed any light on how police officers are to properly handle someone who's disabled. And it seems to me that such evidence would be highly relevant, if not necessary, to determine whether or not the force that was used was excessive.
I believe it could be very helpful. I don't think it would be dispositive. And the reason is I believe that there is, and I think that the facts that we've set forth demonstrate we have a plaintiff who is physically manipulated, and if you believe his version, jammed into a car. Now, I don't believe that anyone would consider that to be an objectively reasonable use of force when there is no attempt to evade or resisting. In fact, I think the record speaks to his cooperation. He's not attempting to leave them. He's not posing a threat. He's not, you know, committing a large crime. This is a minor crime. And the way and the manner in which they put him in there physically, I think that and it's our proposition, that is objectively unreasonable. Obviously, it's objectively unreasonable. But the way and the manner in which you slam somebody in there, I don't think you can make a real distinction. Had they banged his head off the side of the door well, the same thing, it becomes the same thing. You know, just because it was his back in this instance.
What you're saying in your argument is a little different from what you say in your statement of facts. Your argument sounds as if they were deliberately trying to injure him. You didn't say that in your statement of facts. You said defendants put the plaintiff in feet first, causing the plaintiff's legs to spasm. The defendants tried approximately 3 times before they were successful. I take it from that they were having trouble getting him into the car, and then finally they resort to this corkscrewing, causing the plaintiff to slam his lower back. But there's no suggestion in your facts that this is deliberately trying to injure him. Maybe clumsy, you know, ill-informed about nature of paralyzed people. But aren't you embroidering the fact in your oral presentation?
I don't think so, Judge. I think when you look at the 3 times in which the officers are trying to put him into the car,
what are they supposed to do?
Do you disagree that he told Officer Thompson that he wasn't injured?
He didn't say anything.
Well, so. In other words,
you mean the correctional officer? Are you asking about that?
Well, according to the government brief,
there was an intake officer at the correctional facility.
Right.
And he took certain information.
He didn't complain of being injured. He actually told Officer Thompson that he was not injured. Is that?
That was part of the intake sheet. I agree with that. Correct. But we have a plaintiff's version who swore under oath as to the manner in which he's placed.
What is the nature of his criminal record?
Various misdemeanors, basically. I don't know that he had. I don't think he had any experience whatsoever with these officers prior to this incident. His name would have been Ren. He would have showed Run, and his name would have shown some priors. There was no active warrants or anything of that nature at that particular
time.
What's
his corrections ID? He showed them. The driver's license.
He was in the facility at some point recently in the Stevenson County Jail. And it was prior to this, so that in fact was, he had history there. So there's no question of that. But obviously, our whole point is the manner in which they treated him. I think it's just, and obviously it's my perspective, but I think a rational approach would be to pick him up, place him in the car in a sideway manner where you don't have to jam his back in, where you don't have to force him in, we don't have to manipulate his body.
Forgive me. Other than his deposition, what evidence is there of these injuries?
Well, we submitted the supplemental medical information to the defendants, and we never really got into that because obviously we were foreclosed at this early stage, so we never talked about damage.
Why was the driver's license revoked?
I think it was a DUI, if I remember correctly, and this is some time ago. He had a serious accident in 1992, which left him in the condition he is. So with that said, I think you look at all the factors, and you look at the Graham and O'Connor, and then you look at the behavior by the officers and the manner and the way they treated this individual. I think this case is ripe for this court to say that there are these constitutional violations. I think it is patently obvious the way the manner in which they jammed him in there. And I think the court should look to the civilian witnesses who testified that the way they treated him wasn't correct, and the manner they treated him was bad. They treated him badly. And I think there was numerous, I know that the civilian witnesses testified as to that, and that's part of the record as well.
And that you didn't have any police regulations with respect to how handicapped people were treated. That wasn't part of the record.
That wasn't part of the record. We didn't introduce that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hernandez. Mr. Williams?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, good morning. I'm Daniel Williams. I represent the officers Fred Cass and Wendell McLean. Your Honor, there is a substantial disagreement with respect to the facts as counsel has related them to you as contained in the record and specifically with regard to the deposition of the plaintiff. As footnoted in the district court and as reflected in the plaintiff's own deposition, the reason he had a Department of Corrections ID card, Judge, is that he'd been convicted of a number of felonies previously and had previously been incarcerated in the Department of Corrections. His paraplegia arose as the result of, I believe he testified, a car chase where he was being pursued by county sheriff's deputies and crashed into a tree, resulting in the injuries that led to his disability. We are not denying that the plaintiff had the disability which he claims with respect to paraplegia. However, there is a substantial disagreement with respect to what he actually could do with his legs. On the day of this incident, he testified in his deposition, that he'd been down working in an automobile garage that day, that he had braces that he could use for his legs. He had some muscular use of his legs because he could stand. And he was working on an automobile that day. And this incident arose when he was on his way home from working on the automobile down in the garage, down the street, and he was riding a modified scooter where the rear axle wheel had been removed and a double wheel axle had been put on there. He had behind his scooter, his wheelchair was in a little slot box that someone had constructed for him. The officers pulled him over and stopped him because he was driving on a street without headlights or taillights lighted, although the vehicle was equipped with those, and without license plates. At that point, they pulled him over and they asked for a driver's license, and they got a Department of Corrections ID card. At that point, they ran some checks on Mr. Brandt and discovered he was driving after revocation. So they placed him under arrest. And when you place someone under arrest, at that point, you handcuff them. So here's Mr. Brandt still sitting on his motor scooter, handcuffed. They conduct an inventory pat-down search. They find marijuana. At this point, a backup officer shows up, another Freeport police officer named Donald Heath. He witnesses this search taking place. He hears Officer Cass tell him that he's found some substance that appears to be marijuana. Now the question is, how do we get this individual from the arrest scene while sitting on his motor scooter to the county jail? Well, they're not quite sure, so they call their supervisor. I think that's a reasonable thing to do. And the supervisor comes to the scene, and he looks it over and says, no, you're not going to call an ambulance. You're going to put him in the back of your squad car, and you're going to take him down to the county jail.
What do we do with the allegation that Officer Cass pointed a gun at Mr. Brandt's head? Could that allegation alone amount to excessive force?
No, Judge. And I think the only reason that fact is even in there, and I first disagree that he pointed it at his head. He denies he pulled the gun at all, but the plaintiff in his deposition didn't say he pointed it at his head. I don't know where the head comes from. He claims in his deposition that Officer Cass drew his weapon. Officer Cass denies it. However, I think he's trying to bootstrap himself into that case where an officer pointed a gun at the head of a 9-year-old boy who wasn't even a suspect in a case. And in that case, the court ruled that was excessive behavior on the part of the officer for a non-suspect who wasn't in custody, and it was apparently intended to cause some emotional distress in this whole arrest investigation scene. That's not what happened here. We've got a convicted felon. We have him driving without revocation. We have a Department of Corrections ID card. I don't know what reasonable officers are supposed to do other than do what they did. They arrested him, put him in handcuffs, and now they have to get him to the jail. And when they do that, the record says 10 feet from the motor scooter to the back door of the police car. Mr. Brandt has a very different version of how he got to that police car from what all the other eyewitnesses have seen say. But we'll take Mr. Brandt, for purposes of this appeal and this motion, at his word. He says that Officer McLean, who incidentally isn't a full-time police officer, he's an auxiliary officer, he's not authorized to carry weapons. He's there as a ride-along assistant for Officer Cass. According to Brandt, McLean takes him by the ankles, and Cass gets him underneath the armpits from behind. And according to Brandt, they carry him 10 feet, during which he says, that McLean has to re-grip his ankle several times. He then says that McLean puts his feet into the squad car, and then Cass, from behind, tries to push him in the car. That's Mr. Brandt's version of what happened to him. He admits that he wasn't injured when he was picked up off the wheelchair scooter. He admits that he wasn't injured when he was being carried to the car. He admits that when his back came in contact with the door frame during this corkscrewing description, that scraping didn't injure his back. He claims, and he admits, I thought it was very candid of him to admit, that his legs were in spasm. And as I pointed out to you earlier, he admits that he had some muscular use of his legs. His legs are now in spasm. The officer is trying to push him in the car, and he says there's resistance. And he says he notices that Officer Cass finds resistance. And so how is Cass supposed to get him in the car? Cass, according to Mr. Brandt, pivots him and twists him and pushes him in the back seat of the car. The officers don't agree that that's what happened. They have a much different version, and so does Mr. Heath. But taking Mr. Brandt at his word, that's what happened. Officer Kungelman, the sergeant, says, "We've previously transported prisoners in the back seats of cars before that are paraplegic on one other occasion. This does not violate any policy." I think it's interesting to note in this case that in the plaintiff's complaint and in his amended complaint, he never alleged state tort causes of action against these officers for any kind of negligence. He never alleged any complaint against the city of Freeport for having policies that exhibited a different indifference to handicapped or paraplegic people when they were being arrested. As the court pointed out, there's no evidence in the record other than the affidavit of Sergeant Kungelman that the policies of the city of Freeport were consistent with the actions of the officers in this case. So I'm not sure what officers are supposed to do when confronted with what is clearly a unique situation. This isn't a situation where there is gratuitous violence imposed against the prisoner. Counsel dances around that. His complaint sort of danced around it in his response to the motion for summary judgment in the trial court. But he never comes right out and says that this is an excessive force case in the sense that it's deliberate or wanton indifference to the rights of his prisoner. And this clearly is not a case where we have incompetent officers, as I think this court recently noted in the Herzog versus Winnetka case, where we have officers who are clearly acting far beyond the scope of anything reasonable when they take somebody in and arrest them for blowing a 0-0 on their breathalyzer test. So the officers did what they were supposed to do, and Judge Reinhart quite properly adopted the CAPS test of this case, and Judge Reinhart went through the analysis and said, even if ultimately in our hindsight we think, well, they may have been reasonably mistaken, it's still reasonable, and as a result, they're entitled to qualified immunity. I don't have anything else to add to that. I think that's all in my brief. Thank you for your attention.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Williams. Mr. Hernandez, how much time do you have? 1 minute.
I'll address immediately the questions asked to this individual's ID. I have no specific recollection of them being in the Department of Corrections, but if counsel says it, I'll believe them. I don't know what relevance that has to them, because we're not talking about a proposition which just goes to a convicted felon who's free and it paid his time and his debt to society. I don't know that has no change or bearing on it. But if I omitted that, I know he had numerous violations. I just don't remember anything from the Department of Corrections, as I have numerous criminal defendants. My client says he drew a weapon and pointed at him. That was in there. Well, pointing at someone, a weapon at somebody, I think it's a natural inclination to say, well, he pointed at me. The scooter carrying, there's no question of any of those issues, Judge.
Why would they, I find that hard to believe. Why would they pull a gun at?
I wasn't present, but the plaintiff says that they pulled a weapon out on him. Maybe it was because when they radioed in, it came back that he was a convicted felon. Maybe he thought it was. I'm not entirely certain as to those components. This is what the plaintiff tells me, and the plaintiff swears under oath, and he says this to the court. It's an issue, and I think that when you look at the totality of the circumstances, the manner in which they did, I believe that the officers most certainly could have treated this plaintiff a lot differently versus how they treated him and the manner in which they put him into the car. That does demonstrate that this is patently offensive to this particular individual. So I'm asking the court to reconsider this and to reverse this matter.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Hernandez and Mr. Williams.